Hello and welcome to another edition of Inquisitive Minds on Brock Radio, CFBU-FM. My name is Mike Saunders, and each week at this time we explore some of the fascinating research being done by Brock University faculty and students, as well as address relevant issues that could impact the Brock community. On today's show, we talk to a Brock professor of kinesiology about a research project she developed that focuses on boxing being used to heal victims of violence. It was the subject of a documentary film screened in New York recently. We recall the early days of Brock during this, the 50th anniversary year, with a retired professor of mathematics who began his term in our centennial year. And we talk English about French studies with a host of Tic Tac, heard Monday afternoons on CFBU-FM. Raising a glass of French Chablis to Brock's 50th year, Inquisitive Minds is on the air. Late last year, a Brock University kinesiology professor's research program was the subject of a documentary entitled Outside the Ring. It was screened in New York. The documentary focuses on Professor Kathy Van Ingen's research project on boxing to heal victims of violence and was screened at the Shadowbox Film Fest, which features boxing documentaries and films. Professor Van Ingen helped start the Shape Your Life Women's Boxing Program in Toronto back in 2007 in order to help participants heal from the violence they experience in their lives. Kathy Van Ingen joined us in our CFBU studios recently to discuss her project, the film, and why boxing, viewed by some as a violent sport, could help to deal with violence in a woman's life.
It is originally, and it's been a challenge in some parts, particularly around sort of educating funders and getting people to understand why we would want women and trans people who've experienced violence to come into a boxing gym and learn recreational boxing. The program makes so much sense, and actually now we're finding that people are starting to understand the strengths that can come from participating in a program like this much more easily. So the challenge around sort of addressing that question are thankfully getting less difficult.
So how do victims in fact heal through boxing?
What's great about boxing is that it's such a visceral sport, and it's not something that requires you to become skilled at in order to benefit from it. So you can come in to the gym and you learn how to throw just some basic punches. And we're less concerned about manufacturing real boxers or working on making sure your jab is crisp. We do that a little bit, but we're really more concerned with you being in the space, reducing your social isolation around violence, and having the opportunity to just let your body have this experience, which is much more important than acquiring any fundamental skills. So one of the premises is that there's far less space and programs that are available for women that engage their bodies. There's a lot more sort of talk-based programs. Women have access to counseling, which is great and needed. But what often gets left behind in that is their bodies. And their bodies are the very source and site where they're experiencing violence. It's a source of trauma. And when they have an opportunity to take those very same bodies that have experienced the violence and feel that body as powerful in such a visceral way as boxing, connects to them in a really fundamental way. And I think part of this is that boxing requires aggression, right? It is a violent sport. So it requires you to sort of tap into a place where you let your hands go, where you use your fists and you don't talk, you move and you use your fists. And for so many women who've experienced violence, there hasn't been a place for them to sort of effectively deal with that anger. So we work with a sort of concept we call healthy aggression. And what we do is celebrate the fact that your aggression, your anger, is a healthy, normal response to trauma, to violence, to injustice, and that you can use that in a productive way. And here's a safe space for you to hit a heavy bag, a speed bag, hand pads, with a group of other people who are all coming from the same place. And you just get to explore your feelings, your aggression, in healthy ways, with a great deal of support around you. It's safe. You don't have to worry about impacting other people's lives. And you can have some time to sort of use your body to articulate those experiences.
So I would think would offer both an emotional and a physical release for these people.
Very much. And there's an interesting dynamic that happens. There's a moment, and we've this documentary film, where one of the participants says, there's a point at which you're screaming and you don't even know you're screaming. And she's hitting the heavy bag. And she goes, and it's okay because it's other people are doing it too. So, you know, you've got these participants standing in front of a heavy bag, and sometimes just a guttural sound comes out of their voice, you know, out of their throat. Sometimes nothing at all. Sometimes a few cry, or they're just taking such pleasure. So there's a real range of experiences at any given time, but that's okay. And so that healing comes from, you know, engaging all the benefits of what it feels like to have a workout and all the great stuff that happens when you are physically active. But when you have that added benefit of experiencing such a supportive environment in the kind of the mental health stuff is huge in the program.
So what's your personal interest? What attracted you to boxing to begin with?
I came to the sport primarily through reading about it. It has such a fascinating history around particularly race relations as well as gender relations. It was one of the first sports where blacks and whites mixed in the ring and outside of the ring, way back to Jack Johnson and the first black heavyweight champion, and the ways that forced people to sort of address the color bar and the color line. So there's so many great issues that you can look at, and as someone who teaches sport history, it's a great place for me to look at and talk about issues of race and gender and nation. So in part I read my way there, and most of my research sort of requires me, or I want to become a participant in it. So I started training as a fighter. I trained as a fighter for about 5 years. I competed and I became a coach, and I took an athlete from the program, from the Shape Your Life program, to her first fight. I worked with her, you know, for sort of hundreds of hours getting her ready for that. So it's something that I also needed to experience on a personal level as well. And I needed to do that in order to understand through my own body the experiences and the kinds of transformations you can experience when you're boxing.
Yeah, I was going to ask if you had trained yourself as a boxer, or if you were a spectator with more than a vested interest in what goes on in the ring. Mm-hmm. So you've actually done it yourself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I competed as a novice boxer, and essentially you have 10 fights as a novice before you move up into an open fighter. I started boxing in my late 30s, and you're in a particular weight class. You have to fight somebody within a particular age group. And so my pool of people to fight was very small. So I sort of stayed in and fought as much as there was an opportunity to. And then I actually also suffered a detached retina. Mm. Not, in fact, from boxing, but I went and got laser eye surgery so that I could... I was actually thinking about getting my pro card, and I wanted to sort of do this ethnography of the business side of women's boxing, which is its own story. It's a very exploitative world. It's called the red light district of sport. Men's boxing is, and in my opinion, women's boxing is even more in the shadows. So I really wanted to sort of look at it that way. Because my own journey sort of ended in the ring, I had the opportunity to pair up with a world champion, Lisa Brown, who's a bantamweight pro boxer in Toronto, who's been fighting for 10 years. And we'd actually developed this great friendship, and I've traveled to South Korea with her, worked her corner in a world title fight. I've been in Panama, all over the U.S., Canada. So it's great because I've got to see the inside of women's boxing on the pro side as well as on the amateur side. So it's a world I'm absolutely fascinated with, although I also sort of have a lot of cautions in the boxing community too, because we know all the sort of head injuries. And so it's a complicated space, but it's a really wonderful place with a lot of art as well.
I'm curious about if you've got like a small pool of opponents, for example, that you would have had to fight. I would suspect you might fight them more than once. And I'm wondering if, even though that's your opponent, you develop some kind of a rapport with your opponent. I mean, your opponent's in the ring, but outside of the ring, you can have not so much a relationship, but you can at least interact with each other. I think you know what I'm saying. Mm-hmm. Like, you're not always in the ring. So outside of the ring, is there any kind of social interaction with those people that you're fighting with?
Oftentimes there are, especially in women's boxing, when there's a smaller pool of people that you can draw from. It was interesting in my case because one of the women I fought 3 times was actually the woman we hired as a social worker in our anti-violence program. So, you know, I had a very much a working relationship with her and very sort of fundamentally addressing issues of violence against women. And then we would absolutely pair off in the ring, and we would both put away everything else. And when we were competing in the ring, we were competing. We were opponents, and there was no thoughts of anything outside of that at that moment.
Now, we talked about women's professional boxing. Like, a lot of women's sports operate in the shadows of the more popular or visible men's sports, and men's boxing is a big deal. Mm-hmm. Women's professional boxing, how big is it now?
It's interesting. It's always been around in the shadows. In certain places like Panama, it's enormous. Lisa fought in the Roberto Duran Stadium. It was televised there. the woman she fought got a great purse and a house given to her. So in places like where boxing is bigger than it is in North America, it's enormous. In Mexico, Germany, the women fighters can make $30,000, $40,000 a fight. In Canada, a world champion can be offered as little as $5,000 for a fight and might only fight once or twice a year. So these women have to have outside sources of income. There's very few that can live exclusively off of boxing. Most of them work 9-to-5 jobs. They can be the best in the world. Now, there's a few in the States that make pretty decent salaries, but again, they're far and few between. It's easier to sort of cultivate a livelihood from boxing if you live outside of North America. It's an interesting thing, though. Amateur boxing was illegal in Canada until 1991 for women. It was in the criminal code of Canada.
Really?
Yeah. So there were fights that happened that were unsanctioned. So even our history, our official history of boxing, only officially starts in 1991 for amateurs. There were sometimes professional fights that would happen. So women would get their professional cards and become pro boxers without having any or very few amateur fights. So that impacted their skill and safety and, you know, sort of fed into sort of the ways that these fighters were often exploited or used and not prepared properly to get into the ring. So because the history of women's boxing is so short, in an official capacity, there's a lot that we don't know about women's boxing. I just finished a paper that was published in a sport history journal a little while ago looking at African-American female fighters. So we're starting to now put together information about the earliest black male boxers. And we're going back, and the ones that were covered mostly in black newspapers, that where white fighters wouldn't fight them, they weren't given opportunities to fight in heavyweight or sort of world-tide fights, that they've been erased or overlooked in the historical record. And I've always been thinking, we know that women's boxing has been around since the 1700s. We know very little about women of color. The first African-American women we have on record is in the 1970s in the U.S. And I thought, kind of given the labor that black women were doing in the States in particular, the fact that men have been boxing and their spouses and husbands and sons were boxing, it's very likely that these women also fought to some capacity. And what I went back and found was instances of women in the 1860s. There was two black women that were 280, 290 pounds fighting for what they called the Colored Women's Heavyweight Championship title and $20. And so these women, you know, would have been women that spent their lives doing physical labor. They were both married to men that fought and their husbands trained them. And there's very short accounts of these fights, but they were brutal, intense battles that these women fought. And so when we start thinking about women's boxing and its history as being so new, that also overlooks the obstacles that they faced and the women that did fight in these unsanctioned fights or these fights that weren't sort of properly recorded. So that, you know, that's also been an interesting part of the research and a fun part to look at that.
Now let's talk a little bit more about the Shape Your Life Women's Boxing Program. Tell me how the program got its start and when.
Mm-hmm. The program was officially funded in 2007, but it was in 2006 where I learned about a boxing gym in Toronto called the Toronto News Girls. And at the time, the Toronto News Girls was the first and only all-female boxing club in Canada, and I think one of two in North America. And when I went into the boxing gym to meet the owner and the head coach, Savoy Howe, I immediately was struck with how different this space was. It was a boxing gym, but it kind of was more like a community center. It had a sort of politics. She, as a head coach, had her athletes take part in things like Take Back the Night marches in Toronto that addressed violence against women. And she had a traveling boxing ring, and she would have competitors in the ring, or just even recreational participants in the ring, shadow boxing or sparring as we were moving along the streets during the Take Back the Night marches. And this is a very different sort of politics that happens than boxing gyms. So I knew that this was a place that already sort of thought outside of the ring a little bit, that connected boxing to broader social determinants and issues. And so I kept in touch with the coach and said, if I can find some money to do a project, would you be interested? And I saw a grant from the Attorney General's office, the provincial body, and they had a grant opportunity specifically for victims of violence was the terms. What we wanted to do is take that victim methodology and turn it into survivors. So we have this program for survivors of violence, and it's been running ever since then. We have relied on some really innovative sort of funding opportunities. Grants has been part of it, but also we've had an amazing amount of donors. We had one donor give us $80,000. Mm-hmm. We've had tons of people give $20, $5, $100. We are now operating off of a City of Toronto grant for community safety, and we're in our second year of 3 years of that. This program, essentially, it's now open to women and trans survivors of violence. It's been operating for over 7 years, and we've had over 800 participants come through the program. So we have a waiting list every time the program runs. There's a great deal of need to sort of expand, so we're working really hard to keep the program going.
What's in it for the women who take part in the program? They obviously benefit mm-hmm. from it, but how?
The biggest thing that happens, there's a huge waiting list for women and trans people who experience violence that are looking for programs to support them, to support their change or transformation or to leave violence or address the sort of structural things that sort of keep them in places where they're vulnerable to violence around poverty, housing issues, food security, those kinds of things. So what we've done is we've paired up. So it's Brock, it's myself for Brock, it's Savoy Howe, the Toronto News Girls, and we've paired up with this organization called Opportunity for Advancement, which is a Parkdale-based in Toronto organization that works with socially and economically marginalized women. And so when somebody comes into our program, they are placed on a waiting list, and the intake involves them saying, I'd like to be a part of your program. You can collect some information, just get their name, some contact information, and they're in the program. Now, women who've experienced violence often have to go through much more rigorous forms of intake to get into a mental health program or another sort of social service agency's program. That often involves them retelling their instances of violence, which re-traumatizes participants. So, and oftentimes they do that and they'll have to tell their history of violence, which is their own story, and it's a very difficult story to tell, and then they're put on a waiting list. And it might be 6 months, it might be a year and a half until they have access to the program. And yet they've been re-traumatized, or they're still maybe dealing with violence in their lives. What makes our program different is that they self-identify as survivors by coming to us. That's all we've asked from them. And the rest is, what's your name? What supports do you need? So once they're in our program, they have access to, we have a small food bank in the gym. We, more importantly, have access through OFA, the organization we've partnered with, to get them partnered up with legal counseling, support around housing, other issues that they may need. So that's a really important component of this. So if they have access to that, then if they need any supports around clothing, shoes to participate, we do that. If they need help around childcare, which is a huge issue, we provide help with that so they can come to the program, and also free transportation. So for those who require transit, we get them TTC tokens, the both there and back, so that their trip is covered and it doesn't cost them to come to the gym. So those are kind of the supports they have. And then they have the huge benefits of reducing social isolation, which is enormous. And then all the other benefits that come from being in a space that's secular, where it's very diverse. So you can be a Jamaican woman, you can be a South Asian woman, a white woman, somebody from upper middle class, lower class, and you're all in the gym, and it doesn't require that you share your story with anyone. So you're never required to talk, tell your story, and yet some women choose to, and that's also great, and we support that. But there's never any need for any other sort of divulgences, or, you know, there's just acceptance just merely by being there, and that's what makes the program very, very unique.
So how long would they, on average, remain in the program?
So it's changed. We used to have a program that ran for 12 weeks. We have our sort of biggest pools of funding, we can run them a bit longer. Our programs now run 7 weeks, but after the program, participants are offered a free membership to the gym, and they can come back, and we often supply them and keep them with supports. And even if they need continued help around transit, we really work to support them in those capacities. So there's a year afterwards where they can come to the gym and still take part in the gym, and we work really hard. So if they are showing an interest, we'll involve them in a coaching role or in a supportive role in the programs. So we work really hard at keeping participants involved, and many of the former participants have been coaches for a period of time in our program, which is a really strong testament to sort of keeping people involved.
You talked about the funding for the program, Shape Your Life. The film, Outside the Ring, is going to eventually help to fund the program. Mm-hmm. So how dependent are you going to be on that film to fund the program?
You know, we hope that's not going to be our main source of income, because that would be a little scary. But essentially, where the film right now is entered into the festival circuit. So we're using it also as a tool to connect with other like-minded sort of viewers and have them look at the film. And that's a way to kind of reach a larger donor base. It also helps us when we go for funders, but we can sort of communicate to funders. The way we disseminate information and research about the program includes a mass audience, not just other academics, which is big. But we will rely on it in terms of stocking it in different university libraries. There's been a lot of interest from other people that teach a course in sociology or around violence or in gender studies that want the film, so we can sort of send it that way. We've also been offered to air the film on the Fight Network, which is housed in Toronto. So it's just an opportunity to use as a fundraiser, but equally important to share the programs, to share the success of the program, and start to change ideas around what can happen when you let women have access to a program like this, and when you support programs like this. So one of the things that the film doesn't talk about, our program keeps evolving, so there's some new capacities to it. We have to change the canvas in the boxing ring. Now, the canvas in any boxing ring is covered with, splattered with blood. It's splattered with, you know, spit. It's got maybe some tears in the fabric. So the canvas needed changing. And as the canvas was coming off, there was a Shape Your Life participant who also was an artist who said, "Can I have a piece of that to paint on?" And that struck an idea. That was a moment for us. And Savoy recognized that there was something there. And so it's been cut up into 80 pieces. And so now when participants are finished the program of boxing, they're invited back to another session. And this one woman who was the artist that wanted the canvas takes them through a painting session. And again, there's very little instruction. They have access to some acrylic paints, some time, and they get to choose a piece of canvas that could be splattered with blood. It could be a cleaner piece. And then they choose to paint on it and paint their boxing experience. Since then, we've had two art shows. In Toronto, we had one that was a month long and one that was a week long at the Gladstone Hotel. And then they write an artist statement, and they can be anonymous. They can use their boxing name, or they can have their actual name alongside their art. And it's another way for them to sort of break this cycle and to sort of celebrate their lives and where they're going in their lives. And there's been some incredibly powerful and beautiful pieces that have been produced on this canvas. And so it's this other way for them to tell their stories that doesn't require them to only focus on the violence.
That's a fascinating concept, and it just comes by happenstance.
Mm-hmm.
That's oftentimes how these things happen. You come up with a brilliant idea just by a suggestion from one person. Oh, by the way, and it's like, I didn't realize this would turn out to be so big. It's a fascinating idea.
And that's true, and it's really been the way this research has unfolded. I always, methodologically, when people want to talk about your research, this is the methodology of getting lost, where this is a woman, Patty Lather, that talks about research in that way. And when you look at the participants as holder of knowledge and people that know what's best for them in lots of ways, and you respond in and through and with them and making decisions about the program, it's a much different way to approach research rather than I'm the researcher, I have the information, you know, I know what's best, and I'm collecting your data, and then I take your data and I go away. This involves the women as participants, as co-authors of what gets produced, which is a very different kind of way of doing research. And it's the way that I most value research, because I think there's a role as an academic to be a public intellectual and to engage in outside of the academy. And this is a way to do that and to share learnings both with other academics and with other people, and, you know, policymakers, people that work with survivors of violence, and just the general public. So there's lots of strengths to doing this kind of research.
We thank you very much for coming in today, Professor Van Ingen. Congratulations on a wonderful program, and I wish you all the best of luck with it.
Thanks so much.
And that was Brock Professor of Kinesiology Kathy Van Ingen on her innovative research project known as Shape Your Life, the subject of a film documentary screened recently in New York. 2014 marks the 50th anniversary of Brock University. And over the next few months on Inquisitive Minds, we'll periodically chat with some alumni members of Brock faculty and the student population about their time at the university and the impact it had on their lives and careers. Recently, I was joined in the studio by Eric Mueller, retired professor of mathematics at Brock. Now, you might recall he was on the show a couple of months ago as part of the team that developed the eBrock Bugs video game to teach mathematics to students in a fun and innovative way. Professor Mueller came to Brock in April of 1967, our centennial year, and retired in 2004, although he is still a presence at the university. I asked him about coming to Canada in 1967 and experiencing all the hoopla around our centennial year.
Well, in fact, we actually went up to Montreal for the celebrations there. It was Expo, and so we had a great introduction to Canada and to that year by attending that and then camping in northern Quebec and northern Ontario before returning down to St. Catharines.
So what attracted you to come to Brock in the first place? Because you theoretically would have had your pick of any number of universities. Why Brock?
I had come from South Africa, did my PhD in Sheffield, and I was finishing up. We didn't want to go back to South Africa, and so we had a choice of basically going to, we wanted English-style universities. There wasn't many opportunities in England, and there were a large number of opportunities in Canada, so I applied to new universities because I was interested in returning to a small university. I had taught at Rhodes University in South Africa, and liked the atmosphere of being able to interact between disciplines. We weren't isolated. Going to Sheffield, we were in a building which just had math, applied math, statistics, physics, and I felt that there was really little discussion between disciplines. So I looked for a small university and had positive replies from across Canada. What decided me to come to Brock is an interesting story. I got a phone call from John Reed, who was then chair of the math department, saying that he was interested in the education in applied mathematics, classical applied mathematics, and he was hoping that I would be interested in joining at Brock. But what turned the tides was that I received a phone call from London from the then Dean Davis, who said, "I'd like to interview you in London." So I took my lunch in a brown paper bag with my wife Alice, and we took the train down to London, and we went to the address, and it wasn't a university, it wasn't a hall, it wasn't anything, it was a dentist. So I sheepishly went in and I said, "I'm sorry to disturb you, but I have an appointment with Dean Davis." "Oh," said the lady, "he comes here once a year to get his teeth done, and we have a room for him to interview in the side of the building." So I had my interview, and I thought, well, if Brock is that innovative, that's the place for me. So, in fact, I didn't even go to the other universities for interviews and decided to come to Brock straight away. So I arrived in April after finishing my PhD because we were rather low in cash, and Brock offered me a contract until the 1st of July, until my start as a professor. And so that's why I landed up in St. Catharines at Brock.
Just out of curiosity, do you remember how many universities you applied to?
I applied to 5 in Canada, and I was naive enough to think that I could most probably do the interviews in a couple of days, and it stretched all the way from New Brunswick to British Columbia.
That's the common misconception.
That's right.
Before you come to Canada, yeah. It's the age-old story of people get off the plane in the Maritimes and hail a cab and say, "Take me to Toronto."
Yeah.
So you got to Niagara, and you settled at Brock University.
Right.
When you came here, you would have been working, I would imagine, out of the famous, or infamous, as the case may be, refrigerator factory.
That's right.
I've heard so many stories about that venerable location, which actually was still standing when I moved here in the early 80s. Everyone has a story about that location. What do you remember most vividly about working in that location?
Well, we shared the space with the then Teachers College, and when I arrived, John Reed and the other colleague in mathematics was Chang, who's now long, neither of them are with us anymore. But they really made me feel at home. And the great thing about that factory was that the offices were down one hallway and you were interspersed. You didn't have a corner for mathematics and a corner for biology and for the other disciplines. We sort of were all interacting. And I think the big thing was that Gibson really felt that he wanted everybody to participate, and faculty board was the forum in which people participated. And I remember the first faculty board meeting I went to, which was in early June or late May of 67, was a discussion between whether Brock University should concentrate on Eastern philosophies or Western philosophies. And I thought that was really interesting and a real eye-opener for the way in which James Gibson was developing the university.
When the tower went up and you moved a lot of the operations up to the campus as we now know it, now you look at the campus up on the hill and all the other buildings almost obliterate the tower save for the topmost floors. Back at the beginning, you must have been there with all that space and thinking to yourselves, we'll never outgrow this space in this tower.
That's right. And in fact, the tower was to be one of a number of towers. The original design included a number of towers, one which would house engineering and things like that, which never developed. But I think it's fortunate that the other buildings, in fact, mask the tower. The tower is not a very pretty design. I think it serves its purpose because you can see it from everywhere in St. Catharines. But I think it would have been a real pity if we had continued with the original design. I think the connectedness that was developed and the different architecture of the low-rise buildings makes for a much more enjoyable campus than the original design.
So when the tower went up, essentially the whole university, or a large part of it at least, would have been right there in the tower.
Well, what happened initially was that we started teaching in the tower while they were still building And I'm sure that this would not be legal nowadays. I remember going up the stairs to the third floor to teach a course. And because it was raining, the water was running down the stairs. So initially, most of us stayed down in the refrigerator factory. And then when it was finished, the majority of departments moved up, although some of the sciences stayed down below because there wasn't really space for the labs. So mathematics moved up to the 11th floor, which we shared with classics and philosophy and English, which made for a very nice environment for us.
How big was the mathematics department in those early days when you were at Brock?
When I arrived, there were three individuals, including the then registrar who taught a first-year course. One of the individuals went back to Calgary. He had come with John Reed and decided he didn't want to stay, so there were four of us. And then very soon, the department built up with people like Howard Bell and Chuck Lewine joined the department. And John Reed was really, I don't know how he did it, but by speaking to people on the phone, he sort of got a feeling as to how they would integrate into the department. And if you speak to most people in early administration, they will tell you that mathematics was a very stable department, very strong in terms of outreach and in terms of also commitment to things like the Senate and to developing courses for the other departments and so on. So John Reed did a tremendous job of laying down the foundations for a strong mathematics department, which continues to be one a very strong department.
Would you have been able to specialize in those early days, or were you expected to teach several different math courses?
I was very fortunate that John Reed gave me a free rein to develop service courses, because that was not his interest nor the interest of anyone else who was in the department. And the philosophy initially was that everybody could take the same courses. Having had some experience at a smaller university, I knew that this was not very productive, that students who were, let's say, going towards economics or towards some of the sciences would not meet the kinds of standards that John Reed was hoping to the department to develop for its pure math courses. So as a young faculty member, it was really a privilege to be able to develop service courses, which really gave us access to many, many other students, and also allowed me very early on to integrate technology into the math courses.
I wanted to talk about the technology because you're one of those rare birds who took to technology early on and introducing it into the classroom. How much has that technology changed over the years, and are you personally still able to keep abreast of all the new developments?
My interest in technology arose from my PhD studies, where I was using a very early version of what is called a Pegasus computer, which used to be housed in a huge room with air conditioning and had valves and so on. And graduate students were given use of the computer between 2 and 6 at night when the computer was not being used by professors and other people. So I learned very early on that computation had a lot to say, had a lot to do with mathematics, and that we wouldn't be doing a lot of mathematics without the computer. So I came with that attitude. And when I started the service courses, one of the first things that I did was to introduce calculators. Now, calculators in those days were huge desk machines. You turned a crank one time to for adding one and subtracted one, and you had buttons that you moved across for moving to decimal places or to tens, hundreds, and so on. And that was the first machines that we used in the statistics courses. Then these became electrical, so you would plug it in, and instead of having to crank, it would automatically, when you put in the numbers, it would crank so many times this way, so many times that way. So the statistics courses were introduced earlier. Then came the computer algebra system, which was a real revolution for mathematics in the same way that Word and Microsoft Word, and those are a revolution for typing and for English, and they do the same function in mathematics that a word processor does. So I introduced those in basically in the first year service calculus courses, and in fact Brock was one of the places which has had the largest courses on computer algebra systems, and that slowly crept in. And as the computers became more efficient, I mean, initially the computer algebra systems were on a VAC system, and it took each point to be plotted on a graph. It took about half a second. So it was a frustrating time, I think, for some of the students. But we evolved with the technology, and really students now integrate technology in their courses, especially the well-known MICA, Mathematics Integrating Computers and Applications courses, where students actually develop their own, what we call exploratory objects, to look at problems in mathematics which they set. In other words, it's not dictated by the faculty anymore. They are actually doing experiments in mathematics.
Compared to those early days with the hand crank adding machines and everything else, the compactness and the speed of technology today must be just mind-boggling.
It is mind-boggling, and not only that, but the size. It means that now on a small handheld phone, they have access to computer algebra systems. So keeping up with the developments is really very, very time-consuming, and for faculty, it's very difficult to balance that, where we had traditional courses that we built up and we repeated, to courses whereby they are so influenced by the technology now that you spend a lot of time on developing the courses each year rather than just basically repeating the course.
One of the things I love about your approach to education is you're big on the outreach. And we saw that a few months ago when you were in as part of the development team of the eBrock Bugs video game. But it's not just that. You've been very big with the outreach with mathematics for quite some time now. That's apparently, and wonderfully so, so important to you. And I think you should be commended for that.
Oh, thank you. It has been an important component. I felt that it was important to do outreach to teachers, first of all, mathematics teachers in the region and then in Ontario, but also on a more informal manner, whereby I developed what I called math trails of the Welland Canal, so that teachers could bring their classes to the Welland Canal or to Niagara Falls, and these booklets would be available for students to do work around the Welland Canal and the Math Trail and the Niagara Falls.
So I'm looking at, you just pulled this out of your bag here. This is a hard copy of Niagara Falls Math Trail.
That's right.
So you were designing this long before the computer game came along then.
Yes, much, much before that. Yeah, I started the outreach, this kind of popular outreach, in the 70s, which grew more important in the 80s and 90s. I also ran math camps, math and science camps for Aboriginal students. I got some funding from a program out of the U.S., and we had students from Six Nations and other area schools to come here to Brock for a week where they did math and science. Very early on, a colleague, Morris Cohen, who was in the Department of Computer Science, and I used to run Saturday morning computer science and mathematics classes for basically grades 4, 5, 6. So that was in the late 70s. We've tried things like math in the mall, where I had students at tables and we did various math activities, constructions, and so on and so forth. So yes, we tried various other things. Another thing that I think was very successful was that there was an exhibition of Escher works which traveled across Canada. And with some local area teachers, we developed a program to visit the exhibition, which was in Rodman Hall. Rodman Hall at the time was not connected to Brock. And so the teachers would bring the students to Rodman Hall, and they would do, again, some mathematical activities in the context of M.C. Escher. And the reason why this exhibit was developed is that the son of M.C. Escher actually lives in the Maritimes, and he was given some of the things that his father had used, and he passed this on to the National Gallery of Canada in Ottawa. And then we had this traveling exhibit, which we were very fortunate to have at Rodman Hall. It was a year-long festival, basically. We had talks. His son came to talk at Brock, and we had students from different area schools, and we had a special teacher workshop, and we did various things around mathematics and visual arts.
I've just been looking through this mathematics and visual arts program that you brought in. It's fascinating, all the work that goes into this. It's just so indicative of what you've been doing with outreach over the years. Now, you have been retired from Brock since, what, 2004?
2004, yes.
So how much time and how involved are you in the day-to-day life of Brock now?
Not at all. I'm not involved with anything that goes on at Brock, except for very fortunate to have a colleague who came to Brock when I left, Chantal Buteau, and we continue to do a bit of research on mathematics education, focusing on technology in undergraduate mathematics, and specifically the Brock MICA program.
So you're still connected?
I'm connected, definitely, through Chantal.
Eric Mueller, thank you very much for coming in today. 1967 to 2004, that's a good run at Brock, and we thank you very much for telling us about your experiences up at the University on the Hill, and best of luck.
Thank you very much, and I must say that my time at Brock was phenomenal. I had the opportunity in 1972 to go to the Transportation Development Agency of the federal government. I was offered a position there because I had spent a year learning about models, and although I loved Montreal, I loved St. Catharines more, and my love was really for teaching. So that's why I stayed on, and I don't regret it at all.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
That was retired Brock Professor of Mathematics Eric Mueller, looking back at his lengthy career at the university that began in 1967. Incidentally, eBrock Bugs, the Brock video game for mathematics, you can find that on the Brock University website. One of the pleasures of working at CFBU Radio is you never know who you will walk into in our offices and what the discussion might happen to be. Last week, for example, I ran into Catherine Pirer, the host of our French language show we just heard about there, Tic Tac, which airs Mondays at 5 p.m. Catherine is an associate professor and director of French studies at Brock and teaches several French language courses over the course of the year. I asked Catherine to come into the studio to talk in English, mind you, about her work and field of study at Brock, where she has taught for almost 8 years now. And I asked first about her show called Tic Tac here on CFBU-FM.
Well, yes, on Tic Tac, Tic Tac Poétique et Portrait is a show, a radio show on Radio Brock every Monday from 5 to 6. And the person presenting the show is not me, but Clemence Prade, which is about the same person. And in this show, we play a lot of francophone music with French words from Canada, from France, from all over the world. And it's mostly recent, well-known music, top in the charts in France. And then we speak about literature, and we also have interviews with artists, authors, people who have interesting things to say or do in the cultural field. And all in French, for the French-speaking population in Niagara.
Now, how long have you been doing the show?
I started in September 2013, and I'm continuing.
And you're enjoying it?
Oh, I love it. I learn so much. It's so much fun to meet new people, to be able to discuss works with artists and with authors. And it's fun to just speak on the radio. I always have something in mind. For instance, for literature, I prefer to present new work by Franco-Canadian authors. Artists, I prefer to present work by artists who come to St. Catharines for exhibits and the like.
Does that happen often?
It happens quite a bit.
We wouldn't always hear about that. We wouldn't be aware of that fact.
I was very happy to be able to interview artists who come from Quebec, for instance, and even if they are English speakers, well, in Quebec, you want to speak French also, so they're happy to give an interview in French. I also had interviews with actors at the Shaw Festival, so right across the door around here, and who speak French because they've had a national career, because they've been trained in schools where English and French are spoken. And then authors, I'm very lucky on this one because every December there is the Salon du Livre in Toronto. So that's the book fair for Franco-Canadian authors. And there you meet so many talented, interesting individuals. I mean, authors who write in French and who have so much to say about just everything under the planet.
And there's a wealth of French theater in the Toronto area as well. I get mailings quite regularly from some of them.
That too. I do review books that are the result of a new play in French has been played. And it's very interesting, actually. Franco-Ontarian theater is very much alive and very interesting.
There's not a heck of a lot of it down here. You don't see a lot of it move down to Niagara on a regular basis, do you?
Well, too sad, because there would be an audience. I mean, the French-speaking populations of Niagara, and I say populations in the plural on purpose, I mean, we are quite a bit of people who speak French either as a first language or as a second or third language. language. We have one of the largest French-speaking populations in the province, in Ontario, and it's a very diverse population. I mean, French-speaking people who came originally from Quebec, but also recent immigrants, a lot of recent immigrants. This makes for very active communities, very diverse, and of course, very interesting communities.
So let's talk about your work up at Brock. First of all, how long have you been at Brock University?
I came to Brock in July 2006, on the 1st of July 2006.
Okay. Yeah. Presumably, we're talking almost exclusively French studies that you're dealing with.
Actually not. I am a faculty member in the Department of Modern Languages, Literatures and Cultures at Brock. And yes, I do teach literature in French. It's not always French literature, as meaning as from France, but also Francophone literature. This means, for instance, books written in Canada in French. And I also teach in English sometimes. I have taught a few courses in the graduate program, the MA program, Studies in Comparative Literatures and Arts. And this, of course, is in English. And then the teaching was theory. And I like to include art, the visual art, in my teaching, and visual arts also from any kind of country. It doesn't need to be French or French Canadian or French something. I don't really want to be too much language specific or culture specific. I think that everything needs to be comparative and relative, and that the more the better, the more open you are to other disciplines, to mostly to other cultures, the better it gets.
So how many courses would you cover over the course of the year?
At Brock, we teach two half courses on a regular load. We teach two half courses in the fall, two half courses in the winter. And this means, I mean, the number two doesn't mean a lot, but it means a lot of work. You have to prepare, you have to grade, you have to teach, you have to be there to mentor the students and help the students and write letters of references and the like. And you have to, of course, conduct research and do service. So I find it pretty exhausting. I would have liked to remain a student all my life if only I could have had the choice. Yeah.
I've heard that before. You're a professional student.
I am sure.
Now, why would someone want to major in French studies? Perhaps I'm playing the devil's advocate here, but I'm asking the question, why would you want to major in French studies?
For all sorts of reasons. They can range from the personal to the strategic and can be very diverse. I mean, one of the reasons why major in French, this is an officially a bilingual country, so it's nice to be able to talk with your neighbors if they have a different language. And also the job market, of course. I mean, a lot of students at Brock take French so that they can later on teach in high school or middle school. These are not the only positions. I mean, there are also at the provincial, at the federal level, if you want to have a job there in the administration, then it's better to be bilingual. And sometimes you must be bilingual. I mean, jobs, you find them everywhere. You don't need to run to Ottawa. I mean, in St. Catharines, you have jobs for which you need to be qualified in French. And then, of course, in translation, working in a store, I mean, it's nice to be able to speak the language of your customers. Working anywhere, it always helps. And why major? I know, I'm sure, I'm convinced that if you want to pursue your studies, so beyond the bachelor and go on into graduate studies, for me it sounds somewhat strange and counterproductive not to study other languages. It doesn't need to be French, it can be any other language, but studying with one language, especially if you want to continue going to an MA or a PhD, well, you need to be exposed to so many different cultures. You need to be able to read in different languages. I mean, this is about the dissemination of knowledge. Languages are important, and so it should be a priority for every one of us, especially in a place where you have the existing structures for this, to learn other languages. It can only help. Another reason why learning a language is so important, independently from what you want to do later, is simply by learning languages, you become able to develop a different perception of the world, not just of the world, but also of yourself. It's not just about communicating with others, of course, that is important, but it's also about understanding and about understanding oneself, understanding everything. And I've heard students already who study disciplines like business or sports, and they say, well, French has helped me. And you ask them, well, why? Are you going to get a job? Maybe, yes, but also I'm able to think differently. And this, of course, we might say about any language.
So it broadens your knowledge base and just gives you more tools when you go out into the workforce.
Yes, It's certainly an asset, and it is also good for the brain. I mean, the constant gymnastics of switching from one to the other language.
Is there that much of a divide between French language and French Canadian language? I think people have heard over the years French Canadian is different from French.
Well, yes, it is different, but it does not prevent communication. I mean, it's not just the accent, it's also the words that people use and how you express yourself, and also the influence of English or not on your French. I mean, of course, here, if you speak French, you are in permanent contact with speakers of English. So, of course, you will probably import a lot of English terms and vice versa. That's entirely normal, but it does not prevent communication. I mean, if you want to communicate with someone, no matter what other language the other person speaks, you will be able to communicate. It's a matter of will, if you want, of willing to do this.
The language itself, I would think, would be a product of the society in which you speak it. So it would be entirely different, for example, in the eastern townships in Quebec, or if you go to Provence, for example. Again, entirely different. Same language, but it's different because of where you are.
Of course, and I'm very happy that there are variations. Can you imagine the aura of having one standard language and all our thoughts would be molded by this one standard? It would be just a loss of so much for each of us.
My own experience with the French language has been interesting, to say the least. I started back when I was in grade school, we started French in grade six, and I think that was probably one of the last years before they changed it so that you always took French in grade school. But when I started, it was grade six. I had a heck of a time with it. I was not good with it. I did take, about 20 years ago, French immersion, which helped immensely. But again, I'm not fluent in French. But I did something a number of years ago that I was, at the time, proud of, the small, quote-unquote, small victory. I was in Quebec City, and I was on my own, and whenever I had to, I spoke French, and everyone understood me. So I came back feeling, maybe I'm not as bad as I thought I was.
Yeah, and that's the thing about language. It's not about just learning it in the classroom environment, but just using it on an everyday basis. And when you really need a language, let me tell you, you will find a way to say the words. And of course, learning is important, learning at school. And especially, I know maybe students don't like to hear this, learning grammar is super important, in the same way that learning the grammar of your first language should be a priority, like in a very rigorous way. But then you have to practice and you have to be exposed to the culture where a language is spoken. And then you realize that it's an entirely different experience, that all of a sudden all these kind of meaningless learning by heart and saying, not being able to say anything, and becomes meaningful in such a way that it exceeds even meaningfulness. It goes beyond. And it's an enchantment. It's a delight to be able to communicate with people to whom you would otherwise have only very little access. I mean, learning a language, if you have the chance to be able to practice, so to get a little bit out of your comfort zone, to get a little bit outside, and in Canada it's very difficult. You don't even need to go to Quebec to speak to French speakers. They're all around here in Niagara. And if you do this, well, it becomes like a little life of victories and appreciation, a life of where you say, wow, I could do this today, and I've learned this, and I've met this and this. So yes, you need to have the practice.
Now, before we run out of time, I want to talk a bit about some of the research you're doing. Is there an area of research you've done in your time at Brock that has been most gratifying to you, that has really opened your eyes?
Actually, the research I do has very little to do with French. It is not culture specific, except in one case. For one, that was my first area of research. I study Occitan literature, so contemporary Occitan literature, which may sound a little bit strange, because when you think of Occitan, which was one of the languages in the south of France, the, at some point, the one language of southern France, where you're thinking of the Middle Ages and the troubadours, but there is still literature in Occitan being produced, being published, and being read. Very little of it. I mean, it's really a dying language, so to speak, but at the same time, you don't need to have like so many books to write just a few good books, and it's they produce, I mean, Occitan authors do produce a good literature. That's my first interest. And then my other interest is the visual arts, and especially the illustrations in literary text. And right now, with a colleague of mine, Leslie Bolt, who also works in my department, we're just finishing a book project. The book is ready. We've sent it off to the publisher, and there will be many, many illustrations. And we talk about the associations created by the presence of text and images of arts, visual arts and literature, what we can get out of it. And our topic, our specific topic, because this is already really large, is disfigurement. So the disfigurement of the body, but also the disfigurement on an image, for instance, the blur in photography. So we look at very different kinds of disfigurements, and not just on the body, but also about the body or about experience or style that uses imprecision or visual style, like in photography, the blur.
So it's an interpretation, one person's interpretation of that image.
We read, Leslie and I have read different books, novels and short stories, and we've looked at different work, visual works, exemplifying disfigurement as the way we define it, so in a very broad way. And we just offer interpretations, if you wish, I mean, at least a reading, and we try to document this. And there will be in the book should be published in March, and there will be a lot of beautiful illustrations by many artists, some of them from here and others from just all around the world, and from China to Australia and Niagara.
So in other words, you're looking at a lot of different styles.
Oh,
because
yes.
They're coming from all these different countries.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
We do not want to be language-specific, culture-specific, genre-specific. Our topic was disfigurement. What we want to do is to see how disfigurement can be understood and explored. Any kind of exploration.
I think with a lot of people, when they hear the word disfigurement, they think in a negative term. It's something bad or it's something unfortunate, if you will. But disfigurement can mean many things.
Yes, so it can be like a wound on your body, but it can also be a tattoo, something you choose and take pleasure in. It can also be telling a story about the self without really acknowledging that it is the self. It can also be rhetoric, the word figure. Well, why not disfigure the figures? A lot of authors excel at doing this. And then visually, what is disfigurement? I mean, the example we've been thinking of the most, that was most striking to us, was those photographs that you take and they appear blurred. So what can you say? What can you do? What do you do with those blurs? How can you push the exploration further?
So the book is coming out this spring at some point.
We hope so, yes. Yeah. But that's the idea.
Fingers crossed.
Thank you.
Catherine, thank you for coming in.
Merci, avec plaisir.
That was Catherine Perrier, host of Tic Tac, Mondays at 5 p.m. on CFPUFM. Catherine is an associate professor and director of French studies at Brock. That's it for this edition of Inquisitive Minds on CFPU-FM 103.7 in St. Catharines. My name is Mike Saunders. I hope you've enjoyed the show. You can contact me via email at any time at talk@cfpu.ca with show comments and suggestions. Until next week, always remember to have an inquisitive mind. Thank you.